Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. I mean, days
I feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
Sometimes I think I'm a grown-up. Sometimes I think I am responsible. You know, I'm lucky. I have a job. I have a roof over my head. I pay rent. I sleep till noon on weekends because I want to, because I can. No one's telling me otherwise. You know, I have my own destiny laid before me, and it's merely up to me as a grown human to grab it. And then sometimes I feel like I'm a child. Sometimes I feel like I'm completely helpless and not a grown person at all. Well, what does meditation have to do with maturity, being a grown-up? These are some of the ideas that Shastri Ethan Nickturn is going to talk to you about today. This was a talk recorded at our weekly Dharma gathering back in early October. Ethan Nickturn, as you know, is a regular contributor to the podcast. He is the author of The Road Home, A Contemporary Exploration of the Buddhist Path. He will also be teaching a couple of upcoming events at the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York. First, this Wednesday, November 30th, he will be teaching a three-hour workshop, Learn to Work with Difficult People, Holiday Edition. Perhaps you have some holiday encounters that you anticipate, and they might be difficult for whatever reason. How can you use mindfulness to work with those situations? Also, he will be co-teaching with David Nickturn, his father, Shambhala Training Weekend 1, the weekend of January 13th. Mark your calendars if you have been interested in doing Shambhala training but haven't yet found the right time, the right window. This is a great opportunity, a great one to step in on. The weekend of January 13th, 14th, and 15th, Shambhala Training Weekend 1, our introductory weekend meditation course. And now, Ethan, what's this all about? What are you thinking? What's on your mind, baby?
I just right now really wanted to talk about what these teachings have to do with the word that I keep coming back to is the word maturity. Maturity. I think I titled tonight's talk, Becoming the Grown-Up in the Room. And so I want to start with a story about something very simple and mundane that happened to me today. But just to get the question of what does maturity mean going. So I have a few little things I do, as I'm sure most or all of us in this room do, to try to be sort of a conscious environmental person with global warming and climate change, et cetera. And none of them feel very significant. Sometimes I feel like I'm a little attached to mine. But one of them is I really like, and this is my new one, to bring a reusable coffee thermos for coffee and water and tea when I pretend not to be drinking coffee. So I was on my lunch break and I was headed to my appointment at the doctor's office and I stopped in for a coffee at a deli nearby. And this is, I don't know, does anyone else do this? It can be quite frustrating, actually. More in the United States of America, I travel a fair amount. So I've had people in the cafe car of Amtrak tell me that it was illegal for them to serve me directly, that there's a federal regulation against it, so that they would have to pour it into a paper cup and then I could pour it into this one if I wanted to. If you ever fly United Airlines, they're really not into you reusing anything. They just want to keep bringing you plastic stuff, and which ends up in the Pacific Ocean somewhere. I read one article that said there's actually more plastic matter now in the Pacific Ocean than biomass of fish. Has anybody heard that? So anyway, I stopped in a deli. Usually in New York, people are pretty good about this, I find, if you bring your own mug. Do you all find that? So I said, and I tried to say it clearly and kindly, hey, how are you? Could I have a coffee with milk in this mug? And handed the nice lady this mug. And I set it down on the counter, actually. And she turned away and went towards the coffee machine. And I sort of, I realized that she had missed it. So I just kind of, without being too pushy, tried to say, hey, here. And she waved me off in the kind of gesture that was taken as, I know what you want, but I'm doing something. And she brings me a paper cup of coffee and sets it down sort of with a smile right in front of the reusable mug that I had left there. So here's my question for all the mindful people in the room. If you're me in that moment, what's the mature way to respond? What is this, what we might say, what is the skillful action? Any thoughts, what you would do? The most awake you, the Thich Nhat Hanh you, who's 90 years old today, if you were, it's his birthday. He almost passed away a few years ago, so it's really wonderful that he has his 90th birthday. Anyone, what would you do when she hands you the paper cup right in front of your reusable cup?
That's happened to me a bunch of times, so I just say, why don't I pour this coffee into my mug and you can use this cup for somebody else.
Right.
That's it.
So. Yes. Okay, great. Great. That would be... Do they do that? Or because I could imagine her turning around and throwing the paper cup in the trash.
So sometimes they do that and they throw the plastic cup away, but yeah. I say, no, you can use that.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's kind of like I'm teaching them a new trick almost. You know what I mean? So.
Great.
And this happens in Chinatown. So. Yeah.
Yeah, what would you do? Not a suggestion. You're in the situation now.
Hang on a sec.
Bring that cup and they'll refill it all the time.
Okay.
Gives that service.
So go to 7-Eleven. You don't work for 7-Eleven.
No. You can go to any 7-Eleven as long as you buy the cup from them and refill it.
Okay. We should have gotten an advertising deal with 7-Eleven for the podcast before this, but thank you. One more.
I actually own a coffee shop in the city, so I'll take the next 10 minutes to tell you. And I have to leave early. The two are unrelated. But so I've been in kind of both sides of this.
Right.
And when you were saying that, as soon as you brought that cup into the room, I knew where this was going.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. It's just like it's my DNA maybe at this point. Having been on the other side of that, though, I think the best version of myself says something to the effect of, to myself, like, it's not today, you know, and just take both cups and carry on.
Right.
I think, I don't know.
Right. So the best version of yourself just keeps it internal. You're now on the customer side of the counter.
Right, exactly. And I mean, saying that as seeing both sides of it, but also, like, you know, I think we pick and choose.
Yeah.
Right? And so my inner Thich Nhat Hanh would say, okay, you know, not today, and move on.
Great. And if we have an advertisement for 7-Eleven, we should also have an advertisement.
Yeah, don't go to 7-Eleven.
Okay, but where should we go?
I don't know. My shop is in the Lower East Side, so if you're in the Lower East Side, come see me. There are surfboards.
Okay.
You'll see it.
I gave him a shot to advertise. He didn't want to take it. He's really being Thich Nhat Hanh today. Thank you. So that couldn't have been better placed to have someone who's been on both sides of that exchange here, right? So that's the beginning of the conversation of maturity, is the realization of starts to be some kind of realization of the confusion that is often caused by people, meaning us people for now, but more people as well, not understanding cause and effect, not understanding the consequences of how we choose to move through the world, how we choose to express ourselves, and most internally, as we're all working with on the cushion, how we choose to work with our mind. And this can become even more painful, which was, you may have guessed, just because you're living on Earth right now, when there are situations where people have some sense of hierarchy or empowerment or power or leadership who seem to be demonstrating a lack of ability to understand how to work with their mind, how to express themselves, how to... see potential negative consequences to the choices they make in the world on themselves and on others. Does anybody have any experiences in your mind of such a situation? So this is really where the path of our tradition really, I mean, it starts from a very celebratory place, but it starts from a realization and a very humble realization that we are not always our most awake, which is the classic way of saying mature. Right? And that actually causes problems internally. You know, I was thinking, to put it grossly, like, you kind of figure out a lot of times when you get interested in meditation or Buddhism, it's like, my mind is not really potty trained. Like, I'm just making a mess all over the place. And the problem is not that I go to the potty. Every human being does that, right? It's more like I don't know how to do it in a way that is skillful. So before we get into a few of the people I think we might all be thinking about, it's nice to just start with some kind of loving, let's say it that way, acknowledgement of our own immaturity sometimes, right? As Michael's pointing out, he's been on the other side, and maybe somebody lost their mind, not even because they were trying to be environmental. Maybe somebody lost their mind because they didn't get the latte they wanted. It's not a maybe, right? It's safe as a teacher when everything is hypothetical, but nothing actually is hypothetical. So there's some realization of like, oh wow, I don't really know how to work with my own mind. I'm immature, which doesn't mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be a guilt-ridden or shameful thing. It's just like, wouldn't it be nice, wouldn't it create more harmony if I could learn how to work with what's going on internally and then the choices that I make from that in a way that was slightly more skillful, slightly more, I don't know, what are the words? Elegant is a word that comes up. Compassionate. Kind. Present. Any other words? What's that? Productive, yeah, effective, right? Graceful, right? Wouldn't it be nice to, and then the question starts to come up, like, so first, it's just a very personal thing, like, my mind's not potty trained, and it makes for a really difficult personal experience. You know, like, that's the first thing, is if you respond to that situation really poorly, you don't just ruin the other person's day, if you even get to the point where you care about that. You actually ruin your own day. Because it could be hypothetically the case that you are pissed off about that for like the next 4 hours. There are great stories from classic Buddhism about just not carrying things with you, and they don't necessarily mean possessions, like carry your phone with you if you want to be found, but not carrying events with you. And so to realize, like, I need some more training and compassionate way of being so that I can actually mature just for my own benefit, just so that I handle those limitless moments, and that's, you know, that moment I chose very specifically because it's a moment where you've entered it already saying, I'm the mature person, right? You're very, very confident, self-assured maybe arrogant in your own maturity because you care about the environment. And you enter that moment and just to realize that those moments happen constantly. A day is full of those moments. A life is full of those moments. A city is full of people bouncing off of each other with those moments. And I would like, and I have the opportunity to see how could I become more mindful. So that is considered the aspiration that it takes to get onto the path of awakening. And anybody who looks into mindfulness for the first time in some ways, it might not be crystallized, but that intention to learn how to be more mindful, more compassionate, more skillful for one's own benefit because we realize that we might not have received all of the training that we need in school to actually make it through a day of those interactions is the beginning of the path. Sometimes in traditional Buddhism, it's called Hinayana, or the vehicle or journey of, in our tradition at least, self-awareness. Right. A lot of times in traditional Buddhist teachings, the Buddha refers to his students as children, and he's talking to adults, which is always kind of weird and interesting and could seem very patronizing. I don't reckon if anybody here is a teacher and you teach like grown-ups, maybe even if you teach children, actually, I don't necessarily recommend calling them, oh, children. But supposedly the Buddha calls his grown-up students children, and there's a dual meaning to that, which I'll get back to at the end of what I wanted to say. But in there's a recognition of, like, we don't really know how to act all the time, and it's okay. And I think we can actually use the moments where our leaders clearly don't know how to act. I'm not talking about, like, right? I mean, that was why I've never had anybody, a group of people, declare more intensely pained feelings watching a television event than people describing their experience after Sunday night. And it's not because you disagree with one or the other's policies. There's part of it that's just like, this is not adult behavior. Period. And I'll take on saying that, you know. If that sounds judgmental of another, that's okay. But it caused some flashbacks to me. Not being a 70-year-old doing that, but being maybe a 22-year-old doing that and saying like that, yeah, that didn't work out so well. That definitely didn't make other people feel awake. Definitely didn't increase other people's trust in me. So there's a real recognition of, like, I want to try a different way. And at first it really starts supposedly by saying, I want to try a different way because I don't like the way I feel when I yell at a barista. I didn't do that, by the way. I didn't tell you what I did. If anything, there were subtle, like, eye rolls or something. But I don't even think, I think I handled this one pretty well. Who knows? It's all a practice. But right, it doesn't feel good to be that much of a puppet to one's own irritation or anger. So how could I work with that? Not how could I stop feeling angry, because there is some intelligence to being irritated in that situation, don't you think? I mean, it would be hard to admit there's not the person on this side of the counter doesn't have a point. Right? Do you think? I mean, the only thought that's coming ahead is if you want your logo on the coffee cup that you're serving them, but you're not even saying what the logo is. Anyway, we'll talk later. I loved your answer, Michael, because the notion of just maybe now today is not the day. And I'm not saying a point in addressing the behavior. I'm just saying a point in being like the thought arising, we don't have to use one more cup, even if it's internalized. That feels like there's some intelligence there. Just like there might be some intelligence to the barista saying, this is what I've been trained to do. I serve the coffee in this cup, so that's what I'm going to do. There's some intelligence there, right? There's some intelligence on both sides. But we want to elevate the interaction. And that's the second phase of the path, is this realization of, like, you know who you start thinking about at the second phase of the path? Who's the person who hasn't been introduced into this? There's many of them. Who's the closest next person? It's not just the customer and the barista. Okay, so it's the next person in line. Who else is it? The next person you meet. Okay, Michael, who else is it from that's the other side?
The boss,
right? The barista's family, who they go home to, or friend, or roommates, or friends. So you start to think, like, now this is really where it gets very interesting, and maybe a little vague in the network of cause and effect and interdependence, but is there any way I could influence the next person in line's experience? Is there any way what I choose to do influences, in some subtle way, the barista's roommate? Or the owner of the coffee shop, who's actually a friend of ours. That sort of expansion of some kind of vision, none of this leads to perfect action because you still have the response that you have, but there's a sense of a desire to have a positive effect more widely. To not just think of one's own well-being, but the well-being of others, seen others and unseen others. And this is considered the bodhisattva path, the awakening being path. So the view expands. And this is really when one has an elder or a boss or a president or a rock star you look up to. That's almost the worst. When you find out, I remember this crushing blow I received as a teenager. I was a big fan of the New York Mets in 1986. They won the World Series in very remarkable fashion that year. I was eight years old. Everybody on the team, you know, they're baseball stars. And then a biography of the team came out when I was a teenager, I think when I was like 15 or 16. Turns out, like, a lot of the team had cocaine addictions. When they traveled on the road, they would trash hotel rooms. They definitely weren't thinking about me when they did that, right? Or my friends. It was like, this is going to crush Ethan. When this comes out, he's going to have a hard time looking up to baseball players. So that's the other part of as our actions are affecting more people, there is some sense of realizing the sort of reflective and amplified effect of one's way of moving in the world, one's way of working with one's own mind. And if people are paying attention, it becomes more apparent. Now, the flip side of this is when one is a boss or an elder or a president, they're also open to people projecting quite a lot onto them and sort of putting their sense of what confused or compassionate behavior is onto them and judging based on that. So that's the other side of that. But nobody should really want to help lots of other people without knowing that that's going to happen, that there's a multiplier effect to our actions. So there's a sense of wanting to develop maturity for all these reasons. There's a realization, and not to share my political beliefs, but the most Buddhist thing this year was said by Michelle Obama. When they go low, we go high. I don't know who the we or the they she was talking about, right? There might be some projection in that. But the notion that the realization that just answering situations, getting what you want, or reacting to your immediate impulse as a mode of instant gratification or instant relief from a painful experience, right, which is what happens when you're yelling at the barista, is there's a desire to relieve yourself instantly from your own discomfort. Does anyone know, this is why we have the meditation cushion, is you're uncomfortable most of the time on the meditation cushion. There are beautiful moments on the meditation cushion. I saw some people smiling while they were practicing. That happens. That definitely happens. But the best smiles on the meditation cushion really have a quality of like, I'm uncomfortable right now, and it's okay. Or you're just having a really good fantasy. Those are the two ways to smile on the meditation cushion. Or you're thinking about somebody you care for. There's a realization that you really do want to elevate your experience. You really do want to learn how to work with your own emotions, your own thoughts. That's the root, not the ability to have good thoughts. Thich Nhat Hanh smiles a lot because he's willing to be uncomfortable. That's why he's smiling so much. Right? He's willing to work with his own difficult thoughts and emotions. He's not trying to make them go away with some haphazard reactive impulse like yelling at a barista. He might give the barista a Dharma talk about seeing the trees in the paper cup of coffee. He might wait till the barista comes to his Dharma talk. He wouldn't. That's the other good mature piece of advice, is wait till they ask, which is, I think, what Michael may have been saying, not today. Don't give somebody a lecture in their cafe unless you've been invited to do so. But there's a real desire to elevate. And the path to elevation is to make space for our own thoughts and emotions. That's the way to go high in this tradition. To actually have a moment where you're like, I am really irritated right now. I think it becomes very intuitive. And that's the thing, is as there's space around the irritation or the thought of saving the Pacific Ocean or something like that, as there's space around the irritation, there's a kind of spontaneity, a kind of childlike quality. That's the irony of this, is sort of the result of maturing, is there's sort of a innocence, right? This whole tradition is based on the idea that both people in that exchange and all the other unseen people affected by that exchange are good, are inherently good. And so when there's space around needing to do something immediately with the irritation, there's just a like, let's try this and see what happens, you know? Maybe next time I'll try a joke, you know? That could go really well, that could go really not well, in my personal, very personal experience. Might be going really well or really not well tonight. But I have to try it, right? And if there's space around the experience, which is what meditation really brings, is a non-reactivity. Because it doesn't bring non-reactivity on the meditation cushion because you don't want to react, right? You've literally decided, I'm going to sit here and work with this technique to come back. And that trains you to be like, oh, maybe I can trust space. And then see what happens. And you're right, I agree. I think that that's a good course of action. I also try not to use plastic bags when I can get away with it. Now this is the other interesting time is when this kind of exchange, the person is so nice. I was in Austin, Texas last week. The nicest person on the staff who was helping me so much was like, do you need anything? Confided in me later that he was voting for Donald Trump. And I was like, what? Because that's me, right? And that's going to happen, right? So what happens when the person is so nice and is like, no, but you deserve the paper cup. I'm doing it for you. Right? You just have to play with that, you know? Maybe establish a friendship. These things get easier the more familiar we get with the situation. If that's not the only time meeting that barista, right? If this isn't the only time you meditate, you'll probably develop a rapport that's more childlike, more playful, and more mature just because you're thinking about each other's benefit. So does everybody get that sort of ironic? You realize you're really immature, you want to mature for your own benefit, which is called the journey of self-awareness. You want to mature for the benefit of interdependent relationships, which is called the bodhisattva's journey. And that makes you innocent and playful. And just seeing what happens with a good intention. And through seeing what happens, you learn what not to do, right? There's a lot of, I find this is interesting because a lot of the conversation going on in not in the political arena, but more in the communal, or not in the electoral political arena, but more in the communal political arena these days, is about what language different people in our society like to use, like to be addressed with. And there's a backlash. There's a major backlash going on against that because there's the sense of like it's too politically correct, right? Maybe it's just because I was progressively educated. I don't particularly consider that a huge burden, but I get that some people are sick of it. Okay. But language and how people like to relate to each other, it's really a trial and error thing. So if you have a good intention to relate to the other person, you're going to learn what ways that they like to be worked with, right? If you don't have a good intention, it's going to become clear pretty quickly, this person doesn't care about me, which is really immature. This is the hard part about teaching Buddhism in America, is a lot of the premises that American culture is currently founded on are completely copacetic and aligned with Buddhist thought. And some of them, Buddhist thought just decimates. Like, the idea that a person should be entirely self-interested and entirely, not just self-interested, but instant gratification interested. You can't exist in a world like that as a Buddhist person and not call it out. Say, well, that's actually been tried for centuries and decades, and people who really were scientifically looking into what short-term self-interest as your only orientation does, that's the definition of going low, by the way, it always leads to unhappiness. So we have to say that. It might be uncomfortable to hear that personal profit as the only definition of happiness in life doesn't work. Is that too political a statement? It's true. Try it out. Right? And try it out with some sense of like, let me try it. Let me just go for self tomorrow. See how it goes. So, the main point that I wanted to make is this arc between realizing we have some growing up to do, setting an aspiration to grow up for ourselves and others, and that actually returning us to a state of childlike play with ourselves and others. And I don't know if I perfected that today in my encounter with the barista, but I do know there will be another one. So I'll have a chance to practice again. There was a hand over here. Maybe we could just shift into some discussion.
Thank you. As you were talking, what was coming to mind was partly how trying to be the grown-up in the room is, or you know, trying to go high when others go low, is not always perceived externally as being mature. Sometimes it's perceived as like to the contrary of what I feel or what we feel we're trying to do. And so at that point, I think it's like, at least for me, it's important to acknowledge how uncomfortable and how awkward that can be, and even sometimes like embarrassing to sort of hold that tension between trusting your own or trusting my own felt sense of the of like what's needed in this situation, and also the awareness of like this isn't, but others aren't necessarily receiving right. It that way, or it's outside the norm, so people don't quite know what to do with it. Just to give a quick example, like please. This isn't nearly as extreme as you know being irritated or angry with someone per se, but like. So I teach storytelling at the Rikers Island Prison on Tuesdays, and I co-teach with two other people. And today I was like, I was sitting there and noticing how one of my co-teachers like just talks nonstop, and he'll says like, I'm just gonna say this brief thing, and then does a 10-minute monologue or something, and also like sort of jumps on the tail end of what people. What everyone in the group says. And I love this person to death. He's like a brilliant guy. But as a result, I felt that the mature thing to do was to, like, through the whole session, I said almost nothing. Mm-hmm. I was just sort of basically sitting there, and there was a strong part of me that was feeling like, oh, if I were really going to follow my ego, I would probably interrupt my co-teacher and cut him off and say, like, I'm going to cut him off just so that I can get my voice heard in here so I can feel good about what I'm saying. But I felt that what the skillful thing to do was to provide some kind of balance was for me to say basically nothing. And that was perceived as people on the outside were the people in the class. One of the guys said like, oh, this guy over here, he's a thinker. I can tell he's not saying anything. He's just sitting there thinking and more, right. more talking, less thinking, you know, kind of like playing with me a little bit. And I just kind of like, I just sort of thought about that for the rest of the afternoon. I thought that's an instance where my sense of what might have been the thing to do was met with a kind of like, they might not have known what that intention was. Mm-hmm. And so to kind of like sit in that awkwardness is an interesting thing and something that I find myself coming up against a lot.
Yeah. Remind me your name.
Nate.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. It's another, see the thing about the examples that happen off the meditation cushion is they're always complicated.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, who could have guessed that the owner of a coffee shop and a San Francisco Giants fan
right.
would be sitting right there as I'm telling the story. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
The San Francisco Giants ended the New York Mets season last week on a home run. So there's multiple beautiful dharmic things going on there. So, right, they don't know what your intention is in staying silent, right? You know, I think it gets tricky when you tell overly conceptual ideas of what the ego wants to do. The way I like to think about that, Pema Chodron has this word shenpa, which literally means something like fixation. She talks about it as getting hooked. You know, it's not necessarily egoic to interrupt someone. It really depends on the skillful means of the circumstance. But it's really more about looking at where you're getting caught, that getting hooked, and that's the sort of reflex, the sort of almost, it's almost muscular. It's almost yogic to work with, like, is my mind relaxed right now and having a strong perception of this, or am I really caught in my, like, oh, he's really talking a lot. And, but I think it's also, it's a good lesson in just trying things out, you know? Seeing what happens. It's not gonna be the last time the three of you teach at Rikers, right? It's wonderful that you're going to do that, and it's a good practice, right? Those interpersonal spaces are really good practice if you treat them as such. And that's sometimes we use this word practice as like a cliche, right? But really, if you reframe your mind to be like these difficult situations where I feel awkward, where I might not get credit. There's another great slogan in that same body of slogans with Don't Act with a Twist that says, don't expect applause. I love that one. And then you just get applause at random times. It's like, wait, I didn't want applause then. Just see what happens. And most of the ways you know you're moving in the right direction are... if there was some insight that came from it, and in the long term, things seem to be moving in the right direction. If in the long term, people tell you, you're a really good listener, you know? Because I'm sure your friend, that life will give them the feedback that they need if they're open to it. And as a friend, if they ask you for feedback, that would be a really interesting moment to say, well, let's don't do it over text. That's all I'd say.
I actually gave the feedback right after the session today. So yeah.
Okay. If that's part of your structure, which is great to have that, I think that's great.
To bring it back to the barista, I know we've talked about it a lot, but there's still part of it that's like swirling around in my head, and I'm wondering if we left it out or... and just thinking about... like all of the experiences that barista has had that morning, that night, leading up to this interaction, and just the assumptions that we're bringing by thinking, I know it's best, and it's to use my travel mug. And how, I think for me, it's like shifting in my mind to think, like assuming the best, and maybe like the barista, two people before you filled up a travel mug, and it spilled, and the person got upset, so she thought, I'm going to keep using paper cups. Whatever it is, that just assuming the best, and... whether I talk to the barista or not, just I think for me it's like shifting my mind to think about what could have happened with this person's experience that is leading them to this place to not do what I think is best for them.
Right. Great. And what's your name?
Natalie.
Natalie. So I talked about looking forward and you're talking about looking back. And this is the tricky thing, because trusting in basic goodness is like a lifelong process, and these teachings go into all kinds of nooks and crannies about how hard that is. But 98% of the time, if you assume the other person's basically good intentions, things go better. You know, 98% of the time, if you just work with a difficult situation and say, maybe they're having a hard day. Or in some cases, they're probably having a hard life.
I was thinking when you were laying out that situation, in my case, I feel like I would have just taken the cup and not said anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that comes from a place where I'm thinking about, like, well, I don't want to make that person stay bad. I don't want other people in the line to feel bad. And so thinking about the impact of your words or your behavior on other people can sometimes mean denying what you want to do.
Right.
And that's very stressful.
Yes.
So I wonder, like, how you can sort of balance caring about your impact on other people, but also caring about yourself.
Yeah. It's a great question. What's your name?
Hannah.
Hannah. Hi. Yeah. 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 I think this is a super important part of the picture, which is that mindfulness only operates if the mind can really become aware of what's going on. So if you have a moment where you're like, this sucks, you can't pretend that that's not happening, right? And I think a lot of times we think of mindfulness actually as a kind of suppressed equanimity. And so I think bottom line is that for the mind's sort of inherent intelligence to work, the experience, you at least have to be able to report the experience to yourself. You at least have to be able to be like, this is really irritating, and I'm going to let myself, like, I'm going to at least acknowledge that I'm irritated, right? Which is hard, because a lot of times we have a situation where, like, I'm, especially when you get on a Buddhist path, you're like, I'm not supposed to be irritated anymore. Which is exactly why I chose that example, because I wanted to give you all an example of, like, a person who teaches meditation, being irritated. Because if you hang out with any of the people who teach meditation long enough, go to enough cafes with us, you will see, I think you get pretty irritated sometimes. Any of us. And if you, again, if you think Thich Nhat Hanh is different, that's, he's just really spacious and playful with his own irritation. So then the question is, like, is there a skillful way to report this? So I want to say one more part, because we're really getting into the notion of what's sometimes called speech or appropriate speech or right speech. So there's one, not that you would go through this in that quick moment, but in terms of assessing those situations in general, there's one teaching I really like called the four gates of speech, which it's four questions you ask before you express yourself to another person, especially about giving the, like, criticism. The first question is this true? And the second one is it kind? Now, that doesn't mean are they going to like it. It means is it delivered without the twist, without unnecessary harshness or gotcha or the knife twists a little bit. So is this true? Is it kind? Is this the right time? And am I the right person? So the other option is you call a friend and say, can you believe they did this? Which I was using you guys as my friend in that. Thank you all for listening to my irritation. So, but it does need to be reported at least to the mind. Otherwise, you suppress it. And there's two ways we create negative karma in the ancient Buddhist teachings on karma. You have a feeling or a thought arises. You either act on it without awareness, or you suppress it. Either way creates some kind of negative habitual pattern that's going to have a future manifestation. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, and then we'll go.
I just wanted to add on to something I mentioned earlier. So, you know, getting coffee or getting the right mug, but in other issues, you know, we live in a very polarized world at the moment,
yeah,
where, you know, you can get into a discussion with anybody and sometimes you don't, you know, they could have a completely different opinion from you and you don't really know how to handle it, and you can't really decide, like, oh, is this a moment where I need to be in action and I need to not take a passive stance because it could upset them or it could upset their family, but maybe you have to do something. And I think that, I don't know, because if you practice mindfulness, you tend to be more of a moderate person, perhaps, and someone who can have more understanding and more maturity. And I think that that's something that could very frighteningly disappear without people practicing it. And is there, like, an active way of being moderate or, you know?
Yeah.
Because there's just too much of this polarization right now.
There is a lot of polarization, yeah. It's a great question. I mean, it's a question I've if we're talking about the election arena, it's a question I've really taken on, because I don't think to be a spiritual thinker means you don't make choices in the world, and I think democracy requires its citizens to discuss. So who do you think should lead us? Why? So who do you think? I mean, I don't even believe that people should. Their votes should be secret. Because I think when you really look at what democracy requires of citizens, it's people who are in constant discussion about how they think society should be arranged. So it really feels like, to me, it really feels like wrong action to withdraw oneself from that discussion. But you're absolutely right that it's incredibly polarizing. And so I did get into it with my friend in Austin who was, you know, supporting someone I wasn't supporting. And you know, he's from Texas, so I said, so you voted for Ted Cruz, right? Because he was a Republican. He said, no, I voted for Trump. And that fascinated me, that he didn't support the more local, more slightly more traditional, maybe, conservative. And just asked. And he asked me what I thought of Trump, and I said, you know, I'm from the city Trump's from. He's kind of a joke among a lot of people in my city, and I don't know. But we were friends, so I had that conversation. That was my opinion. That was his opinion. That, to me, is right speech. It's not like, let's not talk about it, and then you post something about me on Facebook, and I post something about you on Facebook. Let's actually talk about it. Moderate is interesting, too, because the definition of moderate we're going for is the person who's willing to abide in the space of uncertainty, not the person who thinks every possible perspective should be considered equally, right? If a bodhisattva is in a room with one saint and three murderers, the moderate means the murderers win. That's not the bodhisattva's perspective. From our definition of moderate, like find the median. Moderate meaning I can hold the space for seeing how murderers come about and will take on working with them. That's a very, very advanced example I'm using. But I think what we call moderate in our society is not what Buddhism would refer to as a moderate. Because if there's, you don't want to just go with the average confusion.
I don't think that was the term of moderate that I was trying to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Yes, I totally agree. But if three of the people you're compromising with are murderers, and there's one, you know, that's the interesting question too of existing in the space of how do you be a grown up in the room in that room, you know? I don't know. There's a story. This is a really interesting story. You could believe in reincarnation or not. These stories sort of just serve as a plot device. But there are all these stories of the Buddha in incarnations before his final enlightenment. But he was in these incarnations on the path to enlightenment and learned different lessons. So he, in one of them, he was a pirate on a pirate ship. And the pirate ship got taken over by another pirate ship, and he only a few casualties, but then he realized that the captain was he hadn't committed any atrocities, the Buddha hadn't, but he realized the captain who had taken it over was planning to kill everyone on board, and he had the opportunity to kill him, and he killed him. Chogyam Trungpa was once asked, this is a fascinating question, if you're standing next to a man with his hand on the button that launches a nuclear bomb, and you could kill him, would you? And Chogyam Trungpa, founder of our tradition, said, yep. So that would be moderate in that situation. Shall we close with a bow?
Thanks, Ethan. And thank you all for listening. Hey, visit us at ny.shambhala.com. www.thefreeclub.org. That's our website. You'll find information about classes, weekend retreats, our weekly Dharma gathering, which is every Tuesday night, where you can hear these talks live and in person. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look it up. If you are in the New York City area, come say hi. Come visit us. Tell your friends about the podcast. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions, jokes, anecdotes, and keep striving.